Foreign Ministry spokesman Ismail Baghaei said the resolution diminishes the UN nuclear agency to political leverage, which aims to exert pressure on nations. He said the move is aimed at furthering the intentions of the US and the European Troika regarding Iran's nuclear program. Baghaei underlined that the resolution will be definitely met with Iran's response. According to Baghaei, in an official letter, Tehran informed the International Atomic Energy Agency that a Cairo deal signed between the two sides in early September is now null and void. The resolution passed on Thursday called on Iran to inform the IAEA of the status of its enriched uranium stock and bombed nuclear sites. Iran's foreign ministry says the resolution failed to admit that direct military aggression by the US and Israel in June was the reason why the agency's inspections in Iran stopped. Investigative journalist Tony Gosling joined us earlier to comment on the resolution passed by the IAEA against Iran's peaceful nuclear program. He believes that under its incumbent Director General, IAEA has no credibility.
International Atomic Energy Authority under Rafael Grossi, I'm afraid it looks to me as if it's time to cancel it. Because it's pretty, I think it seems to me it's got no credibility left. So although it's Iran that has formally pulled out of this Cairo agreement on the nuclear program, which effectively was all that's left after the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, which Trump tore up in his first term, the people that really cancelled the Cairo agreement are actually the United States and Donald Trump by bombing the program. So, how can you have any kind of legal agreement or IAEA agreement whilst one of the participants in the dispute is bombing the other one's nuclear facilities? Now, not only is this violating the agreement, obviously, it's also an incredibly stupid and reckless act that Rafael Grossi should have noticed that this could spread radioactive material around. It could actually make large areas of land impossible to use for potentially even centuries or thousands of years to come. So this organisation is not really worth the paper it's written on.
The Gaza ceasefire agreement has not stopped Israel from carrying out attacks in the Palestinian territory. In yet another violation of the truce, the Israeli forces have killed a Palestinian in Khan Yunus, located in the south. Also in Khan Yunus, there has been shelling by Israeli artillery. Elsewhere in southern Gaza, gunboats by the regime's military opened fire on Rafah's shore. Since the ceasefire took effect in the Gaza Strip, Israel has carried out more than 400 violations, killing over 300 Palestinians. And in a broader picture, the genocidal war since October 2023 has claimed the lives of over 69,500 Palestinians. Hamas has once again condemned the approval of the first reading of an Israeli law that paves the way for the execution of Palestinian abductees. The movement said the so-called law marks a dangerous step towards formalizing systematic killings inside the regime's detention centers. Hamas said the Israeli law also turns prisons into arenas for liquidation of Palestinians under the cover of legislation. It described the move to legalize execution of Palestinians as a new and brutal form of legalized bloodshed that blatantly violates international humanitarian law. Hamas says the final approval of the law will provide legal cover for killing Palestinian abductees and replace execution for previous slaughter tactics, including torture and medical neglect. The movement said the international community, especially the UN, is responsible for the consequences of this catastrophic and unlawful escalation. A Palestinian prisoners' rights group also expressed deep concern over the law. The Astra Media Office said it will transform Israel's already biased judicial system into an openly political instrument of revenge. Journalist and political commentator Eric Wahlberg joined us earlier to comment on the Israeli law that paves the way for the execution of Palestinian abductees. He believes that by approving the new law, Israel is actually trying to legitimize its crimes.
They like the legal aspect. They think if they pass a law that somehow this will absolve them of their crimes. But they're legislating a crime. It's a crime to just have direct executions on the spot. That's basically what they're doing. They're saying that any any judge, quote-unquote judge, in the West Bank, when the Palestinians brought before them, they can just have them shot. That's and it's now legal if they have this law. But it's not legal, and it's not. This is something that I hope that at some point the UN can stand up. But unfortunately, it's given everything away to Trump. It basically said Trump's plan, which is to disarm the resistance movement and to let Israel take over and use its own puppets and its handful of Palestinian criminals that it's using to act on their behalf. That's basically what Israel's doing, and it's completely outside of international norms. But Trump operates outside of international norms.
Two Palestinian teenagers have been killed during a raid by Israeli forces on the town of Kfar Aqab near the occupied Al-Quds. Three others were also injured in the raid on Kfar Aqab. The casualties come as a number of other areas in the occupied West Bank have also been seeing military raids and settler attacks. The IOF carried out incursions in Ramallah, Jenin, Tulkarem and Qalqilya. Meanwhile, the Israeli settlers set fire to a car parts yard near Nablus, destroying dozens of vehicles and causing significant damage. Since October 2023, more than 1,000 Palestinians have been killed in attacks carried out by Israeli forces and settlers across the West Bank. Russia says its forces have again captured the Ukrainian city of Kupiansk, located in the eastern Kharkiv region.
Units of the West grouping have liberated the city of Kupiansk and are continuing to destroy Ukrainian armed forces units surrounded on the left bank of the Oskol River.
The top Russian commander also said that Kupiansk played a key role in Ukraine's defense. Kyiv had retaken the city in September, month after it fell to Moscow's troops. The development underground comes as the Russia-Ukraine war is approaching its fourth anniversary. Kyiv has received a U.S. proposal to end the war, with reports saying the peace plan requires Ukraine to give up parts of its eastern territory and shrink the size of its army. Caracas says Washington is trying to make Venezuela its 51st state, vowing that the Latin American country will remain free.
There is a bandit out there promising to be the 51st state of the United States. That is why the importance and relevance of what you do, which is this memory. We will never be a state of any other country. Never. And our people will never obey orders that a handful of stateless bandits and a bandit promise to be the 51st state. We say to the government of the United States and to any satellite prowling around out there, we are free.
Rodriguez also said the Venezuelan people won't accept any form of foreign guardianship. Her comments come as tensions remain high between Caracas and Washington over U.S.'s military strikes on alleged drug trafficking vessels in the Caribbean. President Maduro has condemned U.S.'s efforts to dominate and colonize the region. His American counterpart Trump has not ruled sending troops to Venezuela, while at the same time suggesting openness to hold talks with Maduro. Since September, the U.S. has launched at least 20 strikes on boats in the Pacific and the Caribbean under the pretext of combating drug trafficking. Caracas says Washington's real intention is to topple the Venezuelan government. For months, the United States has been pressing ahead with a campaign of aggression against Venezuela, from striking vessels to authorizing covert CIA operations inside the country. The U.S. has also deployed warships and naval forces off of Venezuela's coasts. Now in Tehran, Iranian students have held a protest expressing their support for the people of Venezuela. A correspondent by Mayama Zacher reports.
Venceremos. We will win. A Spanish message for Venezuelan people from Iranian students across the Swiss embassy in Tehran, which serves American interests. To the protesters here, standing with the oppressed, knows no borders.
This is a gathering by the Iranian students condemning the threats of the United States against the people of Venezuela. As you are aware, there is a continuous threats by the United States government against the Bolivarian government of Venezuela. And why they are threatening Venezuela? Because Venezuela has oil.
In recent months, the United States has deployed at least 8 warships, including its largest USS Gerald R. Ford, and 40,000 military personnel to the Southern Caribbean, carrying out over 20 strikes on Venezuelan vessels and taking more than 80 lives. The U.S. government has labeled these actions as part of a counter-narcotics operation, a claim that these students reject.
The U.S. has always tried to control independent nations using various excuses to justify its aggression, but our people clearly see through these claims.
As part of a nation fighting a similar battle against Western hegemony, these students feel a strong affinity with others who share their dedication to sovereignty.
Whether the people are from Venezuela, Iraq, Afghanistan, or Syria, it makes no difference in our approach. As we've learned from Imam Khomeini, to stand with the oppressed against imperialism. The U.S. tries to impose its rule on Muslims and non-Muslims alike and will always stand with the oppressed everywhere, just as we've stood with Palestinians.
To these students, the importance of resistance is no less than their academic studies.
Revolutions around the world often begin with university activism rooted in a society's academic foundations. A student's responsibility is not only to study, but to also apply the lessons for the betterment of the society and the world.
Trump has reportedly authorized covert CIA operations inside Venezuela. But one thing is certain, resistance to U.S. hegemony will continue beyond all geographical boundaries.
These students say just as hegemonic powers can unite and exert pressure on nations, the oppressed nations can also come together and resist such oppression and hegemony. Maryam Mazarcher, Tehran.
Iranians have marked National Heroes Day, honoring martyrs whose sacrifices continue to shape the nation's culture of resistance. Families of the fallen, senior officials and cultural figures gathered in Tehran, where the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, issued new commendations for books recounting the lives of 3 martyrs. Moin Amini reports.
Vahdat Hall served as the venue for Iran's National Heroes Day. The event brought together people, including families of martyrs, officials and writers, to honor their heroes and reminisce about their legacy.
The key component of our strength lies in the role of families and women. Their support for the fighters ultimately contributes to hero-making and to the transmission of a culture of resistance to future generations.
Across Iran, people find heroism in those who gave their lives for the Islamic Revolution, the 8 years sacred defense, the nation's nuclear and missile programs, the fight against U.S.-backed Daesh, and the 12-day defense against the U.S. and the Zionist regime, offering the world a different definition of a hero.
The works produced in the literature of the sacred defense are of an enlightening and motivating nature, which is the same quality that contributed to the early spread of Islam.
The program was further enriched by the unveiling of 3 commendations written by the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on the lives of 3 martyrs.
The book Endless Fever not only recounts the life of a paraplegic veteran, but also portrays the way a family confronts and copes with this situation.
It was God's will that I became the mother of a martyr, and I must express my gratitude to all mothers of martyrs for raising such children.
The young companions of Martyr Soleimani, who sacrificed themselves to fight terrorism and imperialist schemes, perhaps serve as the strongest proof that the future generations of Iran will continue the path of resistance.
The National Heroes Day is named for the day when Martyr Soleimani's letter to Ayatollah Khamenei marked the annihilation of Daesh. 8 years later, Iranians continue to resist oppression, whether through literature or on the battlefield. Moin Amini, Tehran.
Demonstrators in the Mexican capital have for the second time this week staged a protest against the government. They demanded action to curb rampant violence and corruption in the country.
We're fed up with this Morena government, and it's not just the Gen Z, it's older adults, children, many people coming together for the same purpose, to save Mexico from this narco government.
I came to the march because we're living with insecurity that's become unbearable.
Everyone who's here protesting has a reason. We simply can't live safely anymore.
Around 100 demonstrators hit the streets of Mexico City on Thursday. The protesters demanded accountability from President Claudia Sheinbaum's administration and the ruling party for the country's security crisis. The participants marched towards the main square where government officials were conducting military parade ceremonies, but they were blocked by riot police. This comes after heavy clashes erupted between protesters and the police at a similar demonstration earlier this week when thousands gathered to protest insecurity caused by powerful drug cartels. Pakistan's expanding military cooperation with China is drawing new international attention as questions grow over this partnership and how it is going to reshape the region's security landscape. From Islamabad, the latest developments signal a shifting balance of power that is now prompting scrutiny in Washington and beyond. Our correspondent Ghanwa Muhyiddin reports from Islamabad.
A new report submitted to the United States Congress has reignited debate over China's rising defense capabilities. Citing Pakistan's battlefield performance during the May conflict, the assessment notes Islamabad's effective use of Chinese-supplied weaponry. The congressional report highlights that the systems sourced from China played a decisive role in Pakistan's recent military success, pointing to Beijing's steadily advancing defense industry. The findings are seen by analysts as a sign that Chinese platforms, long dismissed in Washington as second tier, are now demonstrating reliability and precision in real conflict scenarios. Islamabad's expanding partnership with Beijing through joint exercises and coordinated training reinforces this shift. These trends come at a moment when the United States is expanding its own deployments in South Korea and Japan and intensifying patrols in the South China Sea. Regional observers say the growing China-Pakistan alignment is complicating Washington's broader strategy to contain Beijing's military rise. For Pakistan, the cooperation offers technological upgrades and strategic diversification, while for China, it signals greater influence across South and West Asia.
From Islamabad's perspective, the message is straightforward. China's defense edge is becoming harder for Washington to ignore. And Pakistan's cooperation with Beijing is now part of that shifting balance. Anwa Muhyiddin, Islamabad.
And that is a wrap for this hour's World News. Thank you so much for staying with us. Goodbye from me, Bahman Roy.
Things that I've said, no, they don't mean nothing at all. Time just flies by when I'm with the one I love. Even sunlight makes it through the dark in a cold, misty sky. When I'm all alone tonight, you'll be right here by my side. No matter what the world brings, and even if the birds won't sing, better times are on. Even if the sun won't smile, I know it's been a while since I felt any light, but I know you're there. Good times, they never last, I wish they were around. Their time is past us now, still I haven't made a sound. Some folks are dying to live, and others live to die. Somehow when I think of you, I smile deep inside. No matter what the world brings, and even if the birds won't sing, better times are on their way, cause I know you're there. And even if the sun won't smile, I know it's been a while since I felt any light, but I know you're there. The grass was greener on the other side.
first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
The topic, or the title, was The God of Fatima. And the idea was that, inshallah, we get to know Allah better and see if there's certain areas where perhaps we aren't as good as we could be or should be. Brothers and sisters, for some of you, you've had the tawfiq to make ziyarah. For some of you, you may have not had the tawfiq to make ziyarah. Example now. For those of you who have had the tawfiq to make ziyarah, or at least you've seen it online, imagine Allah had given you the tawfiq to visit Aba Abdullah, Imam Hussein. But what happened this ziyarah that's different? You're going to actually have the thawab or the tawfiq to be able to walk from Najaf to Karbala. So take you a couple of days, you're going to be able to walk there. Now, Allah gave you that tawfiq. You were able to be part of the walk. You walked. Now you're there at the shrine of Aba Abdullah. You know, you've heard the hadith that when you stand under that dome of Aba Abdullah, your prayers are answered. Right? We know that. Question, just to think about. Let's say you and I saw someone, a couple of youth, and right there in the courtyard of Aba Abdullah, they were playing on their phones and talking to one another about the latest TikTok video. Right there next to the shrine of Aba Abdullah. So you and I've walked, I pushed myself, I finally got there, alhamdulillah, spent so much money, plane tickets, got there, alhamdulillah, I didn't get sick, I made it there. Now I'm literally there, and I can now go under that dome and ask for anything I need. People have witnessed miracles over there. And how, at least in our minds, we're not judging, in our minds, how would I feel about someone who is sitting right outside of the shrine? And you can literally, it's a couple of feet, just go to Aba Abdullah. And instead of doing that, you're sitting on your phone and you're texting one another about some nonsense. Even if you don't say anything, wouldn't we at least, let's be honest with ourselves, wouldn't we at least feel this person, at least some sense of regret, that you're right here, Aba Abdullah, this doesn't happen all the time. You can just, right? This isn't the place. Go back to your hotel. Go back home. You made it here. Okay? Now, another objective reality. Right, so that's how we would feel. Isn't it the case that this whole world that we're in is the haram of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The world we live in right now, isn't the entire world the shrine of God? Second question, isn't Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, isn't he more special even than Aba Abdullah? Now back to ourselves. In the shrine of God, how much time do I honestly spend working on the purpose of my creation, the reason that I'm here? I'm in the presence of God. Why is it when I'm looking at somebody else, I'm like, look, what are you doing over here? How can you miss this? But then when it comes to myself in the shrine of Allah, that I could be distracted, be playing, be thinking about other things, be, right? So, if we think about that, then now let's talk about something that Imam Sajjad taught us to be. So the right way to be. Imam Sajjad teaches us this. He says, this is a dua from Makarim al-Akhlaq. He says this, asking Allah for this. Wasta'milni, O Allah, make use of me Apply me. Get me to do this. وَاسْتَعْمِلْنِي بِمَا تَسْأَلُنِي غَدًا عَنْ. Make me occupied with that about which tomorrow, يَوْمُ الْقِيَامَةِ, you're going to ask me about. That's how I should be, right? That I am asking God, make me do those things that tomorrow you're going to ask me about. Instead of me spending most of my time thinking about things that don't really matter, aren't really that important, not the purpose of my creation. He continues, وَاسْتَفْرِغْ عَيَّامِي. I ask you, O Allah, make my days empty, make my time available, فِيمَا خَلَقْتَنِي لَا. Make my time available, my days available, for that about which you created me. So the right way to be, according to the teachings of Imam Sajjad, is my focus is on my real reason for being here. What does Allah really want from me? What am I supposed to be doing? So, now, can we really say that everything we do is for, because we're going to talk about what it means to be remembering Allah, to really be at, right? Where are we trying to go with this? What are we trying to ask for? So, there's a question that motivational speakers use. They say, well, what's your why? There was a sheikh who used to ask that. What makes you tick? What keeps you going? What makes you move? What would you feel if you didn't make, if you only had a little bit of time left, that you would be looking for this one thing? The thing is, what we learn from our hadith is this. Death, I'm going to read the hadith, for everyone is sudden. Everyone, when they finally do go back to meet Allah, it comes out of left field. Hadith, the Imam says this, Al-maut ya'ti baghta. Death comes suddenly. Okay. Example now. Example. Once, one of our great maraja, right? Ayatollah al-Uzma, Mirza Shirazi, so that famous marja who made the tobacco fatwa. Once, he was asked, they said that, what about if someone came to you and told you, and it was yaqeen, you only have 1 week to live. What would you do if someone were to come to you and tell you, you literally have 1 week to live? You know what the Ayatollah said? He said, if you only have 1 week to live, you know you're going to die. He said, I would do exactly what I'm doing right now. I'm that prepared. Oh Allah, make my days empty for that which you created me for, and that's what I would do, and I wouldn't change anything, and he's not lying. So, now back to our own selves. How much time do we spend, how much of our lives have we spent on the purpose of our creation? How much of our worries, our concerns, about the purpose of our creation? Because I'll give you what it means. What does it mean to constantly remember God? Constantly remembering God, where we're trying to go, is when I breathe for Allah. I speak for Allah. I'm silent when Allah says silent. I cry when it's something that is upsetting to Allah. I'm upset when it's something that Allah finds upsetting. I'm angry when Allah, everything for me is Allah. I'm constantly in remembrance of Him, and I'm working towards that goal. That's where we're trying to go.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi. كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد
Oh, please. وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The scale of military spending across the 27-member European Union is staggering. On Wednesday, the bloc's executive arm, the European Commission, unveiled a new wave of major defence initiatives.
During the next 10 years, there will be around 6.8 trillion euros spent by member states for defence.
At the same time, more than 93 million EU citizens remain at risk of poverty, roughly 21% of the population. We put these figures to officials at Wednesday's defence briefing.
How do we justify this huge amount of money that we're spending in terms of military?
Of course, every government needs to spend on education, social affairs, everything. You know, the needs are enormous. The trouble is that, if you have, infrastructure attacked, if you have, schools and hospitals attacked like they are right now in Ukraine, all of this doesn't matter if you're not able to defend what you have.
Since 2022, the EU has directed 177 billion euro toward Ukraine, much of it supporting Kiev's military effort. We asked members of the public for their views on military spending versus social investment.
The public support is not there, so I do think we need to strike a better balance and listen a bit better to the population.
It doesn't help either when you mentioned about this corruption, the latest corruption scandal in Ukraine. It kind of, that sways public opinion as well.
No, for sure. Yeah, no, I think that's people start asking questions, and rightly so.
It is very important to focus on the social crisis we're in right now. And so many people are not, like, they don't have their rights looked after, and that should be a primary concern.
If you don't have defense capabilities and if you don't have deterrence, then you cannot really expect to cover any of the other aspects either, because if you don't have the basic safety in the society, then everything else falls wayside as well.
As the Commission pushes ahead with its plans for record military spending, the political risk is unmistakable. Many analysts say if citizens judge their leaders are prioritising arms manufacturers over the basic needs of ordinary people, it will certainly fuel a rise in anti-EU sentiment, the kind that will not only threaten this strategy, but the very future of the bloc itself. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Israeli violations against Lebanon have intensified, with IOF targeting different villages across South Lebanon, striking multiple buildings. This direct assault on residential areas follows an Israeli drone strike on a vehicle in the town of At-Tiri, killing one person and injuring 11. Earlier, the Ain al-Halwi Palestinian refugee camp near Saidun witnessed a massacre. An Israeli strike hit a mini football stadium, claiming the lives of at least 14 people.
It is a message of intimidation to our Palestinian people in the Palestinian camps meant to produce political outcomes. It is one of many forms of pressure that our Palestinian people are being subjected to.
This ongoing bloodshed, driven by relentless assaults, signifies a dangerous escalation in the regime's unyielding campaign against the Arab nation. Hezbollah condemned the massacre at Ain al-Hilwi as a blatant violation of Lebanon's sovereignty. The Lebanese resistance cautioned that any tolerance or weak response would only embolden the enemy, calling for a strong and unified approach to confront and deter the aggression. Hezbollah's Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem has said what Lebanon faces is not a failure to implement the ceasefire, but an aggression.
The events occurring today in Lebanon do not represent a mere failure to implement a ceasefire agreement. Instead, they signify a blatant act of aggression aimed at seizing control of Lebanon and stripping it of all forms of strength, military, economic, and political. Their objective is to take control of Lebanon.
Sheikh Qasem directly addressed the government, urging it to reject external pressures, and highlighted that this is a time of steadfastness. According to the United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon, the Israeli regime has committed over 7,300 violations of Lebanese airspace and conducted 2,400 military operations inside Lebanon since the start of ceasefire in last November. In the face of an enemy that apparently understands only the language of force, a harsh truth becomes evident throughout Lebanon. The arms in the hands of Hezbollah are no longer a matter of political debate. They now represent the country's ultimate and singular deterrent against the Israeli aspirations.
For months, Tulkarem's neighborhoods have been bulldozed, sealed, and emptied during repeated Israeli raids that have turned entire residential blocks into rubble. As the world remains silent, hundreds of displaced families say they have been left to endure their trauma alone, living between relatives' homes, UN shelters, or temporary structures with no certainty of what comes next.
Nur Sham's camp has suffered greatly, and it continues to suffer. The camp has been emptied of all forms of life. We are expressing our rejection of this enemy's policies. This is a stance of refusal, not a plea for mercy from the occupier.
As Duja speaks, her voice steady but heavy with exhaustion, the sound of live fire cracks through the air above us, a stark reminder that even simple interview unfolds under danger.
As much as we are filled with pain over the camp's condition, we are equally proud of it. We are steadfast. If we were not causing the enemy pain, it wouldn't commit all this brutality against us.
New Shams residents say that the same brutality crushing Gaza is echoed here in the West Bank, where nearly a year of displacement have pushed families into tents and overcrowded apartments. Yet even under fire, they remain strong, insisting the world must not ignore their struggle.
Today, as you saw, we came for a peaceful stand, completely harmless. Yet the Israeli military opened fire. We pose no threat. Our situation is catastrophic. We are dying outside our camps and homes. Some people are living in mountains, tents, or paying extremely high rents. We want to return to our homes. Even if only one room remains, we want to go back.
For the people of Nur Shams, return is not a political slogan. It is a survival. After nearly a year of forced expulsion, their message remains the same. They will endure the danger, but refuse to surrender the place they call home. Standing here among the crowds in Nur Shams, you feel the exhaustion, but also the determination. Families who have lost everything are gathered shoulder to shoulder, insisting on a simple right to return to their homes they were forced to leave. Naqa Hamid, Tulkarem, Occupied West Bank.
In May and June of this year, Israeli actress Gal Gadot was in the British capital London to film her latest Hollywood movie. Seven pro-Palestine activists caught wind of the location of the film shoot and proceeded to loudly protest outside the site on numerous days, successfully disrupting the filming and imposing large costs on the production of the movie. Gado, a former member of the Israeli military who took part in the 2006 aggression against Lebanon, is now a Hollywood actress using her platform to advance pro-genocide propaganda on behalf of the regime.
The seven activists were summoned to Westminster Magistrates Court last month. They faced charges of harassment and wrongfully and unlawfully obstructing access to a workplace after pressure was exerted on authorities by pro-Israel lobbyists in the UK. But on the eve of a major hearing on Tuesday, the accused had all charges dropped, with security forces saying that they would receive no further action.
The outcome represents a major victory for the activists, dubbed the Gal Gadot Seven, who in recent months have been facing heavy pressure from the British state, which critics say is acting on behalf of the Zionist lobby in the UK.
I think it's really important to stand up to these Zionist intimidation tactics to show them that A, it won't work, and B, you know, we always have to remember what we're doing this for. You know, we're doing this for the Palestinians, and, you know, it's a very small ask of me, for example, to forfeit 5% of my privilege so that a whole people don't have to lose everything.
The initial court hearing was adjourned due to Jewish extremists attempting to sit in the court's public gallery in order to learn of the activists' home addresses. Sadly for the extremists, they've been deprived yet again of an opportunity to gain key intelligence that would enable them to step up the campaign of intimidation against pro-Palestinian organizers that they're waging in collaboration with the British state.
They're doing this to discourage us, to showcase where they're failing as a state in Britain and across the world, because we are showcasing their flaws, and what we are doing is only right because we are showcasing the truth, because you can't hide it forever.
Critics have pointed to Gadot's wooden performances on the big screen, raising questions about nepotism and whether she's only been given high-profile acting roles in order to promote propaganda on behalf of the genocidal Israeli regime. In this case, the activists not only disrupted the film shoot, but also successfully beat the trumped-up criminal charges they were faced with. East Academy, London.
An article published on Tuesday by the Italian daily Il Manifesto exposed a scheme through which Israel has been cleansing Palestinians out of war-ravaged Gaza for months. The article, titled One Way Trip, describes how Palestinians have been illegally evacuated from the strip through flights organized by a shadowy NGO that goes under the name of Al-Majd Europe. They were taken by bus from southern Gaza's Rafah to the Karim Abu Salem crossing, where they were checked, then transferred to the Israeli regime's Air Force base of Ramon in the Negev desert, without Israeli authorities stamping their travel documents. On Tuesday, Press TV reached the author of the article for more information.
Generally, the Gazans themselves try to contact somebody who helps them leave the localities left in ruins. Strangely enough, this time they are contacted from private numbers by people who have the Gazans' phone numbers. Also, the people who contact the Gazans change every time, and this is very unusual. We checked Al-Majd Europe website, and it appears to be very suspicious. The organization is not based in Germany, as stated by some media agencies.
It is impossible to know how many Palestinians have been deported or illegally evacuated so far. What we know is that tens of Palestinian families have boarded these planes provided by the shadowy Al-Majd Europe organization without knowing their final destination. They paid $1,500 to $5,000 each, the price for children the same as adults. All flights carrying Palestinians taking off from the Israeli Air Force base had African and Asian countries as destinations. One of them reportedly went through Budapest in Hungary, a EU member state, last summer.
No official record of these trips must remain. Palestinians are told not to talk about these trips with anybody. There is no international control on these transfers. The UN and the UNRWA are completely kept in the dark. And the fact that not even the European Union did some background checks on these trips when one of the flights stopped over in Budapest should be a matter of concern for all of us Europeans. It could be our turn to be treated the same way in the future.
an Italian lawmaker has opted to take some action against what appears to be a fraudulent scheme.
Su queste evacuazioni.
I will file a parliamentary question on these evacuations that look very much like ethnic cleansing or deportations. Gazans don't even know where they are taken, and there are many doubts on the organization that is commissioned to run this marquee activity.
A flight carrying 153 Palestinians from the Strip arrived in South Africa on Thursday. The South Africa Foreign Ministry called the flight a part of a clear agenda to cleanse Palestinians out of Gaza and the West Bank. Max Civili, Rome.
The relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia continues to embarrass and undermine claims that Washington actually cares about human rights. United States President Donald Trump rolled out the red carpet for Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman for the first time in 8 years, ever since he became an international pariah for the gruesome murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. When asked about Khashoggi, Trump stunningly defended bin Salman.
You're mentioning somebody that was extremely controversial. A lot of people didn't like that gentleman that you're talking about. Whether you like him or didn't like him, things happen. But he knew nothing about it, and we can leave it at that.
Khashoggi's murder highlighted a number of reactionary ideas: pro-monarchism, anti-free press, an overly powerful executive, use of invasive Israeli tracking spyware, state impunity, ignoring human rights abuses for domestic and personal gain, and more.
Yeah, it just shows the hypocrisy of the United States. You know, we talk a big game about freedom of speech, but, you know, we support people who kill journalists, and nowhere is that more obvious than in Gaza, where hundreds of journalists have been killed.
Trump and bin Salman have had weeks of talks about normalizing relations with Israel, which Riyadh appeared on the verge of doing until the start of the Gaza genocide.
Well, this is about so-called Israel, not a normal country at all, completely the wrong thing to do. I hope Saudi Arabia changes their mind. There's nothing normal about, quote, Israel.
Trump continued to provoke fear about Iran, utilizing Iranophobia to push the sale of F-35 jets to Riyadh.
Bin Salman promised to invest $1 trillion in the United States. Many say that's not a credible figure, as it's essentially the size of Saudi Arabia's entire sovereign wealth fund. Others say that it's a reminder of how the House of Saud stays in power in Arabia in the first place. Ramin Mazahiri, Washington, D.C.
I thought of this before over a million times. Whatever thought that it would be our time, I just know it, 'cause you're the one. It ain't a selfish love when I'm with you. Remind me of the love so I know it's true. I'll just say it, you are the one. Won't you be way. I ask Allah to bless you every single day. I'll just say it, 'cause you're the one. And when times are tough, we've got the world to see. Standing right beside you is where I wanna be. I just over a million times. Who had ever thought that I could call you mine? I just know it, 'cause you're the one. And when there's gray in our hair, we've not much to do. I wanna spend the rest of my days with you. Oh, don't you know it? You are the one. You are the one. Oh, won't you be the one?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khamenei, in a meeting with organizers of the International Conference in commemoration of Ayatollah Mirza Muhammad Hussein Naini, rahmatullah alayh. The meeting took place on October 22nd, 2025. He had a political intellect. He believed in the establishment of an Islamic government. The formation of an Islamic government in itself is a thought. Of course, he didn't specify the form of the government, but he explicitly stated in his remarks in Tanbihul Ummah that an Islamic government must be established. He identifies the core point of such an Islamic government as being the principle of wilaya, or divinely ordained leadership of the Muslims. He refers to it as the hukumat wilayya, a government-based wilaya, in contrast to Malikiyya, istibdadiyya, or usurped despotic governance. I believe he uses such a phrase to contrast the government of wilaya, the Islamic wilaya government, with despotic governance. This means that the model, substance, and spirit of governance is wilaya, which is a very important matter in itself and one that deserves much discussion. He explicitly stated this. A few days ago, I heard something from some gentleman who quoted some noble individuals about Mr. Naini's extraordinary night prayer and tahajjud. The late Aga Najafi was his son-in-law who lived in Hamadan. He was a part of the family and had witnessed this personality. He described Mirza Naini's night prayer, the state he was in during them, his humility, his supplications, and his deep spiritual state. These things existed, and of course, it is these very things that help one find the right path, move along that path, and achieve results. We hope that, God willing, this very interesting gathering of yours, whether it's held in Qum, Najaf, or Mashhad, will be successful. It's good that you've also organized efforts in Mashhad. The late Mr. Milani, Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Hadi Milani, truly revived Mr. Naini's name in Mashhad. This is because what was most prevalent in Mashhad, due to the presence of the late Agazade, the son of the late Ahund Khorasani, was the thoughts of Ahund.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, to Iran Radio, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, broadcasting from the heart of our capital, Tehran. To begin, we invite you to stay with us for today's special, a daily program dedicated to commemorating various Islamic and Iranian occasions with a blend of beautiful Quranic verses, heartfelt prayers, uplifting nasheeds, and insightful reports. This show creates a space for reflection and connection. Don't miss the opportunity to join us in this spiritual journey. After that, take a moment to immerse yourself in Hadith of the Day. Every day, Sheikh Muhammad Ja'far Danish will present a fresh Hadith from the Holy Prophet and his noble family, peace be upon them. Along with each Hadith, he will offer brief yet thought-provoking commentary that resonate with our lives, often aligned with key dates on the Islamic or solar calendar. It is a chance